begin. Last time we had small groups at the end, which seemed very engaged and active, and we didn't reconvene. So I thought we could begin today with any issues that were being chewed over so enthusiastically in the small groups, if anyone wants to bring them to the table or ask me for my views on something in connection with what you were discussing, we can provide some time at the beginning for that. Yeah, Matt.
Our panel, one of the things we talked about was how much easier it is to apply Shavorsky's analysis to a coalition proportional representation parliamentary setup like they have in Europe, where there's a bunch of different parties and they have to form alliances and compromise with one another to get a majority, rather than to a setup which is, well, it was harder for us to think about applying it to the United States setup, where there's two major parties and it's going to be one or the other, and they may need to compromise on specific bills, but they don't need to compromise in the construction of a whole coalition and more systematic questions.
Of course, Shavorsky's analysis is about whatever political environment there might be in which there is a party which is representing workers,
okay,
and therefore faces these choices, particularly in the second of the dilemmas about the extent to which it's going to have an alliance strategy or a pure class-based strategy. But that issue could be played out inside of parties, not just between parties. That is, the alliance issue can be a question of how factions within parties articulate to each other and how they attempt to build their constituency. It doesn't necessarily require a proportional representation with many parties in the field. Indeed, his models basically operate within a two-party framework. There's a bourgeois party and a worker party. And if in fact, because of proportional representation, the Socialist Party is really three parties which form an electoral coalition, that doesn't change at the level of abstraction he's trying to formulate the problem, the essential underlying dynamics. So I think what Shavorsky would say is that these three dilemmas are dilemmas that face any political group that wants to act politically under a socialist perspective on behalf of workers, whether that takes the form of organizing a faction within a coalitional catch-all party or organizing a distinct party within an electoral arena.
I had some questions about Zorsky's argument. We also talked that within our group, and he misses the point that these parties did not born into an advanced capitalist democratic system. In fact, these were the parties who built up, who contributed to the formation of that advanced capitalism peculiar to Western Europe. I mean, he misses the interaction between, I mean, not the interaction, but these social democratic parties were in fact the main actors to form that environment. But he takes as if it's given, and those parties born into these democratic capitalist environments. For instance, if you think about Germany, the Social Democratic Party also took part in the repression of the 1919 revolution, and also some of the leaders of the Social Democratic Party are accused for the assassination of Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht, for instance. Then they formed the Weimar Republic. So these parties, but Przeworski's argument seems to be that he takes these environment, these contexts for granted, rather than as an interplay between these parties and the other powers, other existing powers.
Now that might be a result of the particular chapters I focused on. because in fact, it's an important part of his argument that socialist parties were formed before workers had the vote. So it's an important part of his argument that indeed they were formed under non-democratic conditions. So that the struggle for extending the franchise was the first struggle, basically, of socialist parties when they enter the political arena. That's when they become parties that are contesting for power in some sense, they're struggling to extend the vote to workers, to break down the property-based franchise or other restrictions on working class votes. And that's one of the reasons, that's one of the forces which helps create the ideological, the strength of that initial trade-off, you know, so how loyal workers are to social democratic parties depends in part upon the role that socialist parties place in getting workers into politics in the first place. So that part of the argument doesn't take stable liberal democracy as a given. It's part of the story of the creation of liberal democracy. Now, it's true that for most of his analysis, he's going to abstract from particular kinds of conflicts like the proto-revolutionary chaos in Germany immediately after World War I and how different parties responded to that. Because he's not attempting to explain concrete sequences of events in particular places. He's rather attempting to model some underlying dynamics which parties have to contend with as part of the structure in which they function. You know, so he doesn't, in general, deal with that level of specificity. I don't know, though, if that undermines the cogency of the models themselves and their relevance to understanding the dilemmas that parties face. What you'd have to show that, you'd have to make the argument that by ignoring those factors, he gets the dilemmas wrong. So he claims that socialist parties face this dilemma. If they're elected, should they push forward on a socialist agenda very strongly and thus risk an intensification of capitalist crisis in a way that would make them lose the next election? Or should they attempt to strengthen capitalism? Okay, that's his claim about the nature of that third dilemma. You then study, or somebody studies, the formation of the Weimar Republic and the character of the crisis tendencies of Germany in the 20s and so on. And then the question is, does that show that Szymborski is wrong, that there is this dilemma? I mean, that would be the payoff from saying that he ignores these historical conditions is that if he did pay attention to them, it would show that he is wrong in his general characterization of there being this problem that socialist parties face. To simply point out that he doesn't pay attention to these specific conditions is not yet a critique. Because we can always say that about any abstract theory that's going to attempt to present a simplified account of the tensions or contradictions of a system has to ignore lots of historically specific problems and processes.
Do you think that it undermines his model? Because I don't think so.
I don't on the face of it see how those historical problems undermine the logic of his model. Because I do in fact think that socialist parties in bourgeois democracies do face these dilemmas. And the way out, there's no way out of those dilemmas. It isn't as if there's some clever strategy that a party can somehow invent that would mean it no longer faces those dilemmas. If the historical conditions are such that destroying capitalism is possible, well then it can escape the dilemma, but that's because it escapes the system within which those dilemmas exist. But if those historic conditions aren't present, if you don't have the option of saying, let's get rid of capitalism, so to speak, central committee of the party cannot have a plausible scenario strategy for overcoming capitalism, then they're trapped within these dilemmas. And that's just a hard fact of life. That's just the way it is. You can moan and groan about it, but it doesn't mean that you don't, that you can get out of it. And to pretend you can get out of those dilemmas by arguing we have to be true to our principles and not make compromises is simply a recipe to lose the next election, Chomsky would say. So you, that's one option. You can remain pure and lose elections, or you can try to maximize the space within which new initiatives and spaces can be created for worker initiatives, knowing that to do so you have to also worry about keeping capitalism going and thus sacrificing your principles in some sense. I don't mean to be ranting about it. It's a really difficult idea to fully come to terms with, and particularly, you know, for those of you who have been engaged in left politics and in, you know, various settings in which people really try to struggle with how to transform the world, there is a constant desire on the part of people to find solutions to these kinds of strategic questions where they know how to act in every context because they can follow some basic political formula. I mean, another example of this is just the current, in some ways, ridiculous healthcare debate in the U.S., right? So the House of Representatives made this horrible compromise over the weekend around government payment for abortions. So the plan, which barely passed the House, puts pretty heavy restrictions on, particularly for poor women, of course. I mean, that's the way this thing plays out. It's not class neutral. It's very much going to be hitting poor women. That no insurance plan can cover abortion if it contains a government subsidy. And the government subsidy will be for women who buy insurance in these subsidized insurance pools, well, families that buy, women and families who buy their insurance that way. And so one can say, well, Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats, whatever you might think of them, shouldn't have made that concession, but then it would not have in fact passed. It's not, you know, that would be the case, it wouldn't pass. And so the issue that you have to decide, if you're going to play the electoral game, if you're going to try to expand rights for people and scopes of action within the bourgeois, liberal, democratic state, that's the game we're in. You can't just wish yourself out of it. Then when you come to a situation like this, sometimes horrible compromises have to be made because the balance of power is such that that's the best you can do. And then you can struggle over time to try to change the balance of power, but so long as those are the parameters, that could be the best you can do. Of course, there's a lot of bluffing and posturing in these kinds of conflicts, and you don't know exactly what the limits of possibility are. But I suspect that that was a killer issue. If the progressive Democrats who hate that, you know, who hate this bill, they don't like it at all, it doesn't correspond at all to what they feel is the appropriate solution to healthcare inequalities in the United States. If they had stuck to their principles and refused to compromise, then we wouldn't have anything. And you could say, well, maybe that would have been better. Maybe it'd be better to have nothing than to have this crappy bill passed. That's possible, but that requires you have a pretty strong belief that things have to get worse before they get better, and that the way to make them better in the long run is to allow them to get worse in the short run. That is a view. I'm, as I said, rambling. Yeah.
We had a question that it was more about, so is the driving premise of Chomsky's argument that socialism is kind of diametrically opposed to capitalism, that's why these dilemmas formulate, or is there a more proximate premise that socialism is based in like fundamental ideological values, and these values drive this dilemma? And if it's the latter, then should you find a similar rationale or dilemma formulation with a party like a Green Party or a fundamentalist Christian party, parties that are surrounded, you know, that compose themselves of very strong ideological values, and would they find a similar dilemma structure?
It's not so clear that there would be a similar dilemma structure, though there might be. You know, Christian fundamentalists have had to make all sorts of compromises with their principles in order to gradually gain strength within the Republican Party. You know, they formed coalitions in which they were prepared, for example, to support bills that would merely require parental notification for abortion, whereas they actually thought that such a bill was monstrous because that's requiring parental notification to murder a child, in their view. So that seems, if you really believe that abortion is murder of a child, the idea that it will pass a law that says it's okay as long as you get parental notification to murder a child, that law validates the idea that it's okay to have an abortion, so long as you have parental notification. So they saw the dilemma. They could refuse to support that law on the grounds that they'll only support something which bans abortion, not something that just makes it harder. But then they realized, well, if they do that, they're not going to make any headway. That making this compromise adds to their legitimacy. It enables them to get greater weight within the political arena. And, you know, by hemming in abortion, maybe at some point then they'll be able to kill it altogether. So I think that's probably true, that there are, one could specify a similar kind of logic of dilemmas in which if you are pure to your ideology, you get marginalized. If you compromise on your ideology, well, maybe then you dilute your principles. How sharp that is, I mean, the reason why it's sharp in the socialist case is because of capitalism. Yeah. There's this independent power outside of the state, which is constantly constraining the nature of the choices. In Chavorsky's case, I think for purposes of these models, he pretty much does see socialism and capitalism as binary, because he's defining socialism and capitalism with respect to private ownership of the means of production, basically. So that you either do or don't have nationalized firms that get rid of private ownership. I don't know whether he adopts that as just a simplifying assumption. I suspect in his own political views he sees lots of non-binary aspects to the problem. You know, so there are plenty of ways in which private property can be compromised without being abolished. And this is a theme we'll be discussing, you know, on the weekend retreat as to how important those might be. But simple example, when you have a health and safety set of health and safety rules imposed on owners of factories, what that means is they don't have the right any longer, even if they own the factory, to run it the way they want to. They've essentially lost some rights in what we call private property. Part of their private property has been socialized, as it were. That is, the aspect of the use of machines that have health and safety features are now not owned by the owner of the means of production. They're owned by the community at large in the form of a state rule that bans the use of machines that are dangerous for people. There's no capitalist country which has absolute private property in the means of production. It's all the multidimensionality of those private property rights has been eroded, but only on the margins, not at the core.
Yeah. I had a question related to what Tana was talking about before. Is there any discussion, you had noted that his argument sort of hinges a little bit on the voting issue, but I'm wondering if there's any discussion in other chapters that we haven't read that he talks about erosion of their ideological commitments in terms of voting rights, keeping, like, I'm just thinking in terms of, like, you know, how many socialist movements have turned autocratic, like Soviet Union, and instead of eroding the worker part of it, the sort of socialist aspect of it, actually eroding the democratic portion of it.
Right, so I don't think he, as I recall, in Socialism and Capitalism and Social Democracy in that book, I don't think he discusses that directly, although maybe he does in some places. But it is, I think it logically follows from his account of the dilemmas that one way out of the dilemma of losing the next election is to cancel elections.
Right. Definitely.
So one, his model provides a good explanation, in a way, for why when socialist parties do come to power and face this dilemma of either strengthening capitalism to make it work better or losing the next election, one of the ways they might propose to get out of that dilemma is to cancel the second election. You know, or if they seize power initially through a revolutionary seizure in a non-democratic context, as in Russia, you cancel the first election. You just don't subject yourself to that kind of competitive environment. And revolutionary social, that's been virtually, I mean, maybe a universal outcome. I mean, I'd have to look at it more carefully at the case of that. But certainly it's almost universal, if not universal, that revolutionary socialist parties have, so to speak, canceled the election under which their rule would have been up for grabs. Now you can cancel, you can still have elections as long as you don't allow competitive parties. You know, that's the other solution. The Stalinist constitution is often noted as the most democratic in the world on paper, but the nature of the political arena and the way in which contestation for elections was organized meant that there was zero chance, not just low chance, of the party in power ever being challenged. Yeah.
I was wondering if anybody could speak to, like, the Venezuelan political situation as far as what's been happening with Hugo Chavez's kind of power.
So one of the things internationally, in the international discussions on the left about Chavez, one of the things that has made many people on the left who support the words of what's said by Chavez. So if you look at what Chavez says, announces about the program, it has all the right symbolic trappings, popular empowerment, serving the needs of the poor, redistributing power. I mean, all along the line, the language of the Bolivarian Revolution sounds completely congruent with socialist ideals. And it's true, he came to power in an election, and which in the initial elections certainly were, by the standards of global elections, reasonably competitive and free, and, you know, and so on. They met international standards. He survived a coup, which was an anti-democratic attempt to remove him from power. So the setting at the early stages was one where there was really very broad support on the left internationally for Chavez. Then there's a series of moves that he makes, structural and constitutional moves, which make people nervous, which raise issues as to what's really going on here. One is the elimination of term limits so that he can keep getting reelected. A second is forcing the many, he was elected through a coalition of many parties, basically forcing the dissolution of all of those parties under a single party. You know, the form of that was by telling the other parties, you're perfectly free to stay separate parties, but if you stay separate parties, no member of your party is going to get into any political positions, and you're going to be completely marginalized from the process. So it's, you have a free choice. Either you dissolve your party and join my party, or you remain an independent party and have no role in the government whatsoever. You know, in effect, it was an attempt to create a one-party monopoly. Now, what's unusual about the Venezuelan case, quite remarkably unusual, is the degree to which opposition forces, as opposed to so there's been a dissolution of the coalition into a unified party, more or less. What one would have expected the next move to be would be a repression of the opposition, and that hasn't happened. There is a lively opposition. There are defections from from his own party into the opposition as people have become disgruntled, either for personal reasons or for principled reasons. And that hasn't been massively repressed. I mean, there's more open contestation than is historically the typical case. And that is a sufficiently unusual feature that I don't think it can be just kind of dismissed as window dressing. I think it represents the fact that there is not this has not yet taken the form of a consolidation of a fully authoritarian solution to these dilemmas. Yeah, Joao.
One simplification, then one question. The discussion of endless re-elections in the Venezuelan case was actually put into vote. They had a referendum about that. So at the same time, it wasn't imposed. It was
right.
And actually, Chavez's position lost.
The first time. So plebiscitary elections to ratify changes, you know, it creates a big legitimation issue. You know, you submit this to the vote. Sometimes that's a legitimate democratic move, other times it's extremely manipulated. And the way you manipulate it is you package it with other things. And you make it all or nothing, right? And then it's true that it was subjected to a vote. And I don't think the vote was rigged, as far as I know. Still, it doesn't make one less.
I recognize all the problems of the Chavez government, but at the same time, what I think is challenging about talking about its government, it has many positive facets. For instance, it has organizations in the neighborhood, it has politics of healthcare on the ground, it has, even though a shy but an existent land reform politics, it has an understanding of redistribution, it has several social benefits that just were unimaginable to the Venezuelan people, and it has an importance in the geopolitical arena in the way that Latin American countries.
Right, so I think it's a very contradictory movement. Authoritarian populism always has benefits to the masses. You know, Perón had benefits to the masses. I mean, it's a characteristic aspect of a strategy of consolidation of power to have benefits to the masses of a certain sort, and the question. You know, the questions that get raised are how accountable is the regime, how much is it building authoritarian structures to control these organizations at the base so that they become instruments of the state rather than autonomous actors, and it's often extremely hard to get good information on that because the self-representation of the supporters of the regime are always, as they were in Stalin's time, you know. There were factory committees in Stalin's time that proclaimed to the world that these were autonomous worker collectives controlling organization of production. So it just becomes extremely difficult to know exactly what's happening because there's such ideologically charged and self-interested representations on both sides of the issue. So I'm not saying that that implies we should assume exactly the opposite. But I just think it's extremely problematic to know exactly what the dynamics in play here. And particularly the, you know, what does look like Chavez's egomaniacal desire to have himself, the kind of cult of personality aspects of things, and his desire to have a quite considerable concentration of power in his hands, without there being democratic accountability inside of the political formation that he's creating. All of that makes one worried about him. Yeah.
And the main problem in the Venezuelan case is that he was elected without social movements, without a structured political party. He came, he got the power because of his charisma, because of his influence, and then he had to build the structures. And then he had to face several kind of dilemma.
Right.
I wouldn't say that it's mostly because of his ego. I think he has a political problem. And it's...
Well, but, you know, when he gives 6-hour speeches,
but that's how he got elected. He didn't have, a party.
So
different from the Morales case, in which there was this, the movement of Cochabamba.
So all of these are explanations for the, and they're explanations. This is an interesting kind of scientific discussion. So that's what you've pointed out, is to a set of hypotheses. So the hypothesis is, if you are an authentic revolutionary socialist, then you happen to also be charismatic. That's a kind of luck, you know, from the gods. You're a charismatic leader. You have those skills to be able to inspire and mobilize people. And you get elected under adverse conditions where you don't have well-organized parties and social movements. Then the best you can do is to create, is to do a strategy of the sort Chavez is doing. And the counter argument is, yes, that may be the best you can do, but what you create as a result of that is a top-down authoritarian structure which assures the reproduction of your power and all sorts of consequences follow from that. So I agree completely with the thesis that this is a deeply contradictory context in which we don't have clear way of knowing what in what direction the contradictions will unfold. I just get apprehensive when the trappings of formal democracy are treated as not very important, so that you can force all, you know, all parties to become part of your party. You disallow factions within your party. You repress dissidents inside of your party when they are critical of you. You know, all of those kinds of tendencies, which one can say, yes, but he has no choice, so it's possible, nevertheless, are anti-democratic tendencies that bode poorly for long-term prospects for a real democratic socialism. Now, possibly democratic socialism is impossible. That's another.
It seems to me that there's sort of like, while a lot of the rhetoric from Venezuela is very like revolutionary socialist, it seems like the political programming followed is more like Latin American populist. And I mean, I've seen situations where he has sort of like, seems to be moderating his own sort of, you know, like nationalization of oil and these sorts of things because of like fear from his own like coalition that there's, you know, aren't working well. So, I mean, it doesn't seem like, I mean, and the fact that I guess he's continuing with like elections and this sort of thing, that the program isn't entirely like revolutionary socialist. It seems to be more populist. I mean, you disagree with that?
No, that's certainly one appropriate way of describing what he's doing. But there are these aspects around land reform and, you know, there's this very ambiguous movement around cooperatives, for example, which on the one hand looks like it's empowerment. On the other hand, a lot of these co-ops are scams for ripping off public monies or for destroying unions. So, yeah, it's, again, it's a
fraught with contradictory aspects. Tatiana.
Yeah, it's that I was thinking that Chavez and Venezuela case has another important thing that we have to know, and it's that he has done land reform and other policies that look like socialist, but without a clear criteria. So it's accidental. You can expropriate anyone if you want. And that's a problem. And the question then is, the Socialist Party is going to be allowed to do everything against the other parties or not? Because it's a democratic regime in which you are embedded, right? So one of the things in Venezuela is just not a socialist because the policies are socialist, because they seem at least, but it's the, in the application and enforcement of those policies, there are no clear criteria for that, so it's really accidental. And then you can avoid the next election because you're covering this mass media. So you had four channels, for example, for news, and then you have one. So you're, it's a lot of, I don't know, confusing and contradictory things. And the other thing is that it's socialist in the policies, but it's a capitalist state because it's based in the oil economy. So it has some other things that you have to include in the analysis to see if the dilemma of the parties is real, is really that kind of dilemma or not.
One of the things I read that kind of, I don't know much about Venezuela, but I read an educational article about how he was kind of moving the educational system, especially in elementary, towards more ideological indoctrination type education, and kind of taking the rewriting history to kind of solidify his image, especially with younger children, which, you know, is another contradiction, I think.
They erased the 4 years before Chavez from the textbooks of history classes.
Yeah, that was it.
So that is a way to build the history.
Right, although, you know, American high schools erase.
Yeah.
So we have a lot of variation because it's such a decentralized system that I think Madison public schools have a pretty progressive and balanced open teaching of history, but Texas public schools are another matter. So I don't, it's undoubtedly true that things like that are happening. I don't think Chavez's actions in those regards are particularly extreme on the spectrum of what we observe in the world. Going down to, I mean, Italy only has one television station too, owned by Berlusconi. So Italy has more channels, but Berlusconi dominates the news media on television in Italy, I suppose perhaps not quite as much as in Venezuela, but you know, we're talking about degrees, they're not total. And it is still the case that basic civil liberties and freedoms of speech and so on and freedom of opposition are more vibrant in Venezuela than one would normally expect from a regime that is bent on dictatorship. It's, you know, and he has lost the Chavistas have lost elections in some regional elections, and that sort of thing would not normally be tolerated in a, if it was as simple as this is an authoritarian regime wanting to consolidate the power of a corrupt leader. You know, if that story was right, then there's all these anomalies. Other thoughts from the last session on and the sort of democracy in the state? We don't have to keep on this particular theme. Is there any issues that came out of your discussion that anyone wants to raise? All right, well then we can move on to ideology. Another terrifically interesting topic. As I'm going to argue over the next lectures, the study of ideology, I think, is the place where questions of, on the one hand, psychology actually come in. In a sense, a Marxist theory of ideology can be thought of
as the core of a Marxist social psychology. And it's basically about the social conditions under which beliefs are formed, which is a social psychological question. Because beliefs are held by human persons with minds, and the process by which the beliefs you hold get to be held has a psychological side to it. The theory of ideology, therefore, is one of the places in the Marxist tradition where micro and macro analyses most sharply come into interaction. Because the formation of beliefs has an absolutely foundational micro aspect to it. You know, whatever else is true about the way people form beliefs, individuals have to be doing the listening to receive the messages, to internalize them and interpret them in various ways. Minds are not macro phenomena. Now, shared beliefs are macro. That is, the fact that beliefs are shared matters tremendously. And that's a crucial aspect of Marxian theories of ideology, along with many other views on these matters. The shared character of the beliefs are what give them social relevance. Nevertheless, what's being shared is being shared among persons who hold the beliefs in their own consciousness. And that's why the study of ideology seems to me the site within Marxism where micro and macro come together most acutely. And where indeed, as we will see when we read some of Elster's work on this, a fully elaborated theory of ideology needs a cognitive psychology behind it. Cognitive psychology, which is the psychological aspects of thinking, of cognition, is essential to have a fully elaborated theory of ideology. When we talk about mystification, that is, how our perceptions of the world become systematically distorted, you can't have a theory of mystification unless you have some theory of perception of how human beings with their perceptual apparatuses and their cognitive capacities perceive the world. Well, you can treat it as a black box, you can have it as a kind of unspecified set of internal mechanisms, but there is some processing that goes on in order to generate the distortion. If people are to have their perceptions distorted by the experiences of everyday life, you need a set of mechanisms which have to in some way be anchored in psychology in order for that distorting process to be systematic. And thus again, I think Marxist theories of ideology, theories of fetishism, I mean all these fancy words, alienation, all these words that Marxists use are ultimately anchored in some kind of cognitive social psychology basically as being the core of it. So, what we're going to do today is give this is another one of the sessions that's a kind of general dictionary section. We're going to discuss the words, what the word ideology means. I'm going to introduce a number of distinctions because, as in all of these kinds of linguistic conceptual problems, words get their meanings through their contrasts with other words. That's really where you get the specificity. So I'm going to try to give the idea of ideology quite a bit of specificity, and then play this out through Joram Terborn's account of how ideology works. I think that his book, The Power of Ideology and the Ideology of Power, is a terrific book. I think it's, in my view, it's probably the best single piece systematic work on ideology that I know. A lot of what those of you who have read Bourdieu extensively, a lot of what Terborn says is very similar to what Bourdieu has to say, except he said it earlier, and he embedded it in a Marxian problematic in a way that Bourdieu doesn't. But Terborn's discussions of subjection and qualification as the way of thinking about how ideology forms subjectivity, which we'll discuss later, that's very close to Bourdieu's discussion of habitus. Very similar in many ways. For those of you, I mean, I know those of you who are grad students in sociology are going to be taking courses with Mustafa Emirbayar, who's a big Bourdieu fan. I think Bourdieu is certainly worth studying carefully. You might, as you engage Bourdieu, have Terborn's account of ideology in the back of your mind to think about the counterpoint between the two. It's a nice essay to be written by somebody, so this is an invitation for somebody at some point. As far as I know, there's been no essay in sociological theory that is a careful, systematic discussion of the differences between Terborn and Bourdieu as a way of thinking of the formation of the human subject. And it'd be a nice kind of comparative theory paper to write at some point. Somebody here, one of you, could get a nice publication in a journal like Theory and Society or Sociological Theory to play out that comparison. Okay, so let's begin with the discussion of ideology. First, the word. The word ideology gets used in all sorts of different ways. Sometimes ideology is the contrast to science. Ideology is a way of talking about false ideas. So to say that's ideological as opposed to scientific. An ideological claim is a claim that's driven by a set of beliefs that are unvalidated by science. So one contrast is to say ideology is the other of science. Another use of the term ideology is to say ideology are systematic configurations of beliefs as opposed to chaotic beliefs. So some people think ideologically and other people think chaotically, unsystematically. There are voters who come to the polls with very worked out ideologies, so they know exactly how to vote on any given issue or what candidates to support because they have a coherent view of the world. And therefore they can interrogate any given issue and say, aha, this I shouldn't support because it's outside of my program of coherent beliefs. Other people have all sorts of inconsistent beliefs, their cognitive structure, their view of the world is disorganized. They hold completely contradictory beliefs. You know, they believe two things, both of which cannot be true, and they don't worry about it. Just go ahead and believe it. The idea that people can hold completely inconsistent beliefs is something which intellectuals find a little bit uncomfortable, makes them uncomfortable, but in fact most people, probably all people, hold completely inconsistent beliefs. But certainly, when we're talking about political beliefs, it's a standard thing. There's an important study done in the 40s, it's called The American Voter by Converse. It's one of the benchmark studies in immediate post-World War II creation of sociology and social science as a major academic activity. And he draws the distinction between ideological and non-ideological voters. There are voters who will just vote on a particular issue. There are voters who have a coherent view of the world. And a third meaning of ideology is that ideology is a multidimensional concept that really maps all socially relevant aspects of beliefs that people hold. And some of them are true, some of them are false, some of them are systematic, some of them are chaotic, but they're all ideology. Ideology is just the way we talk about, and the study of ideology is the way we talk about, the multidimensionality of the beliefs that people hold. Now, I think there are linkages among these different usages. They're not completely independent of each other. You don't exactly have to choose between them. I'm not going to attempt to create a fully resolved conceptual map here, you know, of all the different ways you can use ideology and how they fit together. But let me begin with just describing one terminological distinction I'll make. In effect, it's the distinction between ideology as a noun and ideology as an adjective. Then I'm going to draw, once again, the contrast between ideological practice and other kinds of practice. This is repeating some things we've said, but I think it will be helpful. And then I'm going to try to give more specificity to the concept of ideology by drawing a contrast with culture. I think by clarifying the contrast between ideology and culture, that will help to give ideology itself more precision. That's kind of the agenda for the first part of my comments. So first, a terminological convention. When you use ideology as a noun, as when you say an ideology, bourgeois ideology, capitalist ideology, Marxist ideology, socialist ideology, etc. When you use it as a noun, there, I think, what you're talking about is a system of beliefs, a more or less coherent system of integrated beliefs. So there are many different ideologies in that sense, when you're using it as a noun. When you use it as an adjective, particularly in the form ideological practice, what you're talking about there is the process of producing beliefs that are incorporated within the subjectivity of persons. An ideological practice is the process of producing beliefs that people hold in their subjectivity, the beliefs that people actually come to believe. That's an ideological practice. If those beliefs are coherent and form some configuration, then you can refer to the set of beliefs themselves as an ideology. Ideological practices therefore need not produce an ideology. They can just produce a jumble of incoherent and loosely connected beliefs. And that's partially because people are subjected to a whole heterogeneous set of ideological practices rather than a coherent set of practices. So when I use it as an adjective, I'm talking about the process of production of something. When I use it as a noun, I'm talking about what it is that's produced. Okay. Now, let me then go through this litany of different types of practices. So now we're drawing a contrast across the adjectives, right? Yeah.
So ideological practices precede an ideology. How do you call the reflection of the practice?
But everybody who engages in a practice has ideas in their heads already. So it's not the case that ideological practices precede ideology, because it's never the case that there's a person engaged in an ideological practice who doesn't already have beliefs. Right? So it's a recursive process. It's true that babies don't have ideologies. Babies do not have beliefs. Right? So ideological practices occur from early infancy. They're practices involving parents and children, through which children acquire beliefs through these ideological practices that take place in the cradle, so to speak. But very quickly, young children are already engaged in ideological practices, producing beliefs, not just being the object of ideological practices. But you should think of it as a recursive process. Recursive means it just goes around. You know, the causes go back and forth rather than in one direction. Okay, let me just remind you again of this, of the main trilogy of practices, but then I want to introduce some further distinctions. The trilogy is economic, political, and ideological practice. Each of these can be thought as a process of production of something. All processes of production have an input, a means of production, and an output, and a labor process, so to speak, through which the means of production are applied to the input to produce an output. That's the kind of paradigm of what we mean by a production process. The economic production process is the iconic form. Nature is the raw material. Human laboring effort with using means of production transforms that input into an output. And the output are useful things that satisfy human needs. An economic practice, then, is a practice by which nature is transformed through labor processes and means of production to satisfy needs. In the capitalist context, that's embedded in a whole structure of relationships, which include production of useful things and their exchange as commodities, etc. That's economic practice. What's produced in political practice? What's produced in political practice are social relations. The relations between people are the product of political practices. In the micro case, it's the personal is political. It's the kinds of ways in which, through our interpersonal interactions, we generate the relationships between persons. Ideological practice, then, is the process of producing the conscious dimensions of subjectivity through the transformation of human lived experience into beliefs. Ideological practices produces beliefs. Yeah.
Can you say a word about the difference between subjectivity in the ideological sense and social relations in the political sense?
Social relations are the relations between persons, and subjectivity are the internal states of persons.
Okay.
The internal mental states of persons.
Okay.
Subjectivity only exists within social relations. We're not atomized separate beings that live off in trees. We are social beings, so the claim that our subjectivity is an internal state of our mental life does not imply that it's either formed independently of other people, nor that its content isn't, in its very central features, related to other people. The content of our beliefs, of our social beliefs, is all about our connections to other people. Now, so the gendered aspects of your subjectivity are all about the relations between men and women, not just about some isolated, separate thing called woman or man. The content of beliefs are relational, but nevertheless they're internal to the person.
So that interchange would mean that to have a total model of subjectivity, we would also need a model of social relations and vice versa.
Well, or I would say to have a total model of subjectivity, you need an account of economic
and
political. So to have a total account of social interactions, you need an account of the economic, political, and ideological practices. The practices are the activities, the relations are the interconnections among activities. So ideological practices produce cognitive products. They're the aspects of subjectivity that are part of our consciousness. Now, that suggests the distinction that I like to draw between ideological and cultural practices. This is not, as I think I've said already in some earlier time when I alluded to this, this is not authoritative. My use of this contrast between ideology and culture does not correspond to standard usages, although I do think many standard usages actually implicitly are drawing the distinction this way. But still, some people use the term culture as an all-encompassing term that includes ideology as a subset of culture. Culture are all symbolic and cognitive products whatsoever. Let's not worry about how other people use it. Let me try to explain what I'm trying to get at by my contrast between ideological and cultural practices. Cultural practices, I argue, is the process of producing the non-conscious aspects of subjectivity. Cultural practices generate personality, dispositions, habits. Ideological practices produce beliefs. Beliefs, the conscious aspects and the unconscious aspects, dispositions, may or may not have a close correspondence. we think of them in a stable person, a person who's well integrated, living in a stable society, that ideological and cultural practices have a close rapport with each other, but they need not. Let me, in my notes, let me jump to page 3 of the notes, if you're tracking this on the notes, and then I'll come back to page 1. Let me jump to page 3 to strengthen the contrast, the intuition around the contrast between ideology and culture, by discussing the distinction between a patriarchal ideology and a patriarchal culture, and thus the ideological practices, patriarchal ideological practices and patriarchal cultural practices. So patriarchal ideology are a whole set of beliefs about the nature of gender and sexual difference, about the naturalness of the sexual division of labor, of the desirability of men doing men's work and women doing women's work, and of the naturalness of those distinctions. So that in a patriarchal ideology, it's natural and desirable for women to do nurturing emotional work, and it's natural and desirable for men to do aggressive and competitive tasks. These are natural distinctions that are then, and the beliefs in these natural distinctions are what we would call a patriarchal ideology. The inculcation of those beliefs we would call patriarchal ideological practices. All the ways in which those beliefs are transmitted and come to be believed by people. You could look at advertising, for example, and the symbolic use of masculine and feminine stereotypes in advertising and in children's television. And in sports broadcasting, you know, all these venues where these beliefs get articulated and transmitted and come to be believed. That's patriarchal ideology. Patriarchal culture, on the other hand, is the actual socialization of men and women into masculine and feminine personality traits and dispositions. Developing the disposition to be nurturant is an aspect of culture. Believing in the desirability of nurturance is an aspect of ideology. Now, we think of these as corresponding to each other. You know, we think that men both hold, in a patriarchal society, both come to hold the belief that it's good to be macho, and they're macho. They're actually good at it. They develop the dispositions. So the average man is more macho, so to speak, than the average woman, because their actual dispositions have trained them to, in an automatic, in a way that is experienced as natural, act in that way. That's exactly what Bourdieu means by habitus. I think that's precisely what he is talking about when he talks about habitus. We think, therefore, as there being a natural correspondence between cultural and ideological practices, but there need not be. What the women's movement calls consciousness raising is precisely the view that you can change people's beliefs about the desirability of certain traits, even if you haven't yet transformed the traits themselves. So women can come to believe that it's undesirable, it's not natural, and it's not desirable, that men are aggressive and women are nurturant. These are both human traits, and that women need to be more aggressive and men need to be more nurturant. What is called assertiveness training in the feminist movement, was an effort to teach particularly young women at the time, teach them in the art of aggressive competitiveness so that they could put themselves forward and stand their ground and state their piece in the same kind of forthright way that men had learned to do. And there was the belief that by beginning with ideology, convincing people that these weren't natural, and that it would be desirable to change. And then giving people training, you could change the underlying dispositions as well. Once you've changed the underlying dispositions, you've changed the culture, not just the ideology.
Yeah.
Maybe you can clarify this for me. I feel like one of the big distinction here is the conscious and unconscious distinction. And I feel like maybe there are, like, especially within gender relations, there are kind of unconscious beliefs sometimes, where it's not so much, it's a very, like, muddy concept that I probably haven't developed enough, where it's not, it's a kind of as a result of just being raised within a certain culture and ideology. I'm using that correctly.
There's taken for granted beliefs.
That's what I mean.
But that's not the same as the belief itself being unconscious.
Well, is it conscious if you never thought about it before?
It's conscious if so long as you recognize it instantly when you're told it. That is, I don't have an objection to the expression unconscious belief. When I say that it's a belief, what I mean is if I asked you the question, do you think it's natural that men are aggressive and competitive and women are nurturing, even if you have never held the idea in your head, it is natural that thought hadn't actually been in your repertoire. But the moment it is told you, you don't have to think. You don't have to go through some careful analysis. You say, yeah, of course it's natural. Because you know what the words natural mean, and you have a general view of there being natural and unnatural things in the world. That's something that you understand. And as soon as it's called to your attention, this question, you immediately say, oh yes, I believe that. So one could say that was an unconscious belief in the sense that you didn't consciously know that you held that belief, so to speak, until you were asked about it. But you instantly knew that you knew it, so to speak.
But then the difference with cultural would be that just the moment when you make conscious the belief?
It's that cultural refers to the underlying dispositions, personality traits, ways of actually interacting in the world. When, and this corresponds to a lot of what people think about as culture. When people say, for example, that there's a characteristic sense of humor in Jewish culture, what they mean, but of course not all Jews are funny, so to speak. Not all Jews are good at actually telling those kinds of jokes and having that kind of ironic, playful version of a sense of humor. But what they mean is that there's something in the way that language is developed and that stories are told that people develop a disposition towards having this kind of ironic view of life. In a culture that also creates a huge value in verbal playfulness, and those things together create this distinctive thing that we call a sense of humor. Well, the culture cultivates the dispositions. The beliefs in the desirability of those of that kind of sense of humor, those would be ideology. In this case, it's more cultural than ideological, I think. We can make the same point about bourgeois ideology and bourgeois culture. So bourgeois culture refers to all of the unconscious dispositions and habits. Habit is an important aspect of culture, the things that become just habitual, embodied routines. And personality structures that enable people to function effectively in markets in a competitive way. All of the habits of living in a competitive world and the dispositions that you have would count as culture. The beliefs in the efficiency of private enterprise, the justice of the distributions that it produces, the superiority of capitalism over all alternative systems, the desirability of free enterprise, mean, all of those beliefs count as bourgeois ideology. And again, bourgeois ideology and bourgeois culture need not, in any given person, need not fully correspond. People can believe that it's a really good thing to compete, and they may be really bad at competing and feel terribly uncomfortable being nasty to other people in order to get ahead. They may not have internalized in their habits and dispositions bourgeois culture very effectively. And yet they can still believe, you can still believe that competition is a good thing, even if you're not very good at being able to do it, because for whatever reasons you haven't internalized in your way of being these dispositions and personality traits that are needed to be a good competitor. A given concrete practice that a person engages in, for example, disciplining a child, may contain both ideological and cultural aspects. So when you discipline a child, what are you doing? You're doing several things. You're communicating beliefs about what's good and bad, and the child's beliefs about the world are in various ways affected by the act of disciplining. But you're also shaping their dispositions, shaping the kind of person they are, their personality, their habits, and so on when you discipline a child. So disciplining has both a content and a set of, or may have both a content and a set of beliefs, reinforcing some beliefs and undermining others. And it may form these more unconscious aspects of their subjectivity, which I'm referring to as culture. The possibility of contradictions between ideological and cultural practices, I think, is fundamental to the possibilities of social change, of deliberate, intentional, strategic social change. And it's central to the Enlightenment view, of which I think Marxism is one of the heirs to the Enlightenment. It's essential to the Enlightenment views that you can change people's beliefs independently of changing their dispositions, and that changing their beliefs is the point of entry into transforming their willingness to act. So that you'll have men, in the context of feminism, who are perfectly adept macho competitors. They have all the dispositions and personality traits and skills to behave that way. But they become convinced that that's not a good way to live. It's not a way to respect the women they care about. And it doesn't constitute the sorts of relations which they feel would be desirable in the world. They've engaged in consciousness raising in the sense that their beliefs have changed, but their dispositions haven't changed very much. And so they have to work on their dispositions. And that becomes a project of self-transformation, in which the leading edge is the change of beliefs through argument and discussion, and thus the idea of consciousness raising. That is, I think, an essential part of the Enlightenment view, that changing beliefs can change a person's character. But there's a lag in the process because changing dispositions requires work. It's not something that happens instantaneously. If you believe that consciousness is everything, you know, you don't believe in all this unconscious stuff, then it's simply where there's a will, there's a way. You know, you change your beliefs and that's it. You don't need to worry about these underlying dispositions. If, on the other hand, you're a really deep Freudian, you know, you believe that the unconsciousness is everything and that consciousness is just superficial, epiphenomenal, then you believe that no amount of consciousness raising is going to change these underlying dispositions. Dispositions once formed are robust and durable and are essentially unmovable. I think those two extremes are not right, and that we have both conscious and unconscious aspects of our subjectivity. I think that the left project for transforming collective action to transform the world gives a privileged role to transforming consciousness as a way of transforming subjectivity as a whole. But it's not, you know, the left in general doesn't rely exclusively on that. Why, after all, do you combine the messages of social transformation, the beliefs with music? And why is there such a rich tradition of song on the left as part of the way in which it sees its project of transformation? Well, I think it's because of the way music acts on emotion, on feeling, and therefore aids in the transformation of non-conscious aspects of subjectivity, not just conscious ones. Lectures would be enough, so to speak. You wouldn't need all these other ways of transforming how people feel in the world if we were just cognitive actors and didn't have unconscious aspects, which also can be structured and transformed through our collective and individual practices. And that's why I think cultural and ideological practices really go together. Okay, back to page one. I've drawn the distinction between ideology and culture. Let me draw one other distinction, which is going to be even tougher. This is certainly going to not clarify things for many of you. It'll just make things more confusing. But I nevertheless think drawing the distinction between ideological practices and what I'm going to call theoretical practices, or you could substitute the word scientific if you'd like, scientific practices, why I think we want to draw this distinction as well. Scientific or theoretical practice is the process of producing knowledge of social relations through the transformation of ideology as a raw material. That is, what scientific practices do is transform beliefs that people have into knowledge. And the means of production are the technologies of science, of social science in the case of scientific beliefs. The means of production of knowledge are a set of scientific tools. We call them concepts and theories and observational technologies and other kinds of technologies. You take those tools and you apply them to the raw material of human beliefs and you produce knowledge. Let me give you a simple example of the contrast between a theoretical practice or a scientific practice on the one hand and an ideological practice, which we will discuss again when we deal with mystification. And that has to do with the transformation of our understanding of the relationship between the earth and the sun. Okay, so you're sitting on a hillside watching a sunset, and what do you observe? You see the sun moving towards the horizon. Let's imagine it's a beautiful ocean, you know, you're on the west coast, and you see the dipping down below the horizon, and you see the sun disappear. And you ask yourself, what just happened? Okay, you've just had a lived experience. Directly, we have eyes and optic nerves and brains, and we're able to see something happening. What we saw happening was the sun going around the earth, heading down towards the horizon and disappearing. That's what we saw. That forms a belief in our minds, the belief that the sun goes around the earth. Right? That's a direct transformation of lived experience. We experience this as a lived experience, something we perceive, into a set of beliefs. For most of human history, those were the beliefs that human beings held about the motion of the sun relative to the earth. And for obvious reasons, that unless you have a theory of the implications of being on a planet with the sun being very far away and the effects of gravity on the body sitting and watching and so on, unless you have all of that additional theoretical knowledge, then what people do is just translate directly, in an unmediated way, their perception of motion into a belief about motion, because it corresponds to every other perception that they can ratify with other senses. What Copernicus does is teach us that we got it wrong, that we weren't taking enough into account when we looked at this phenomenon, and that in fact it's the Earth turning on its axis. That's what's really going on. The Earth is revolving on its axis. We are in a fixed position, and the Earth is moving this way. The Sun isn't moving. I mean, the Earth is moving this way, right? If you're on the hill and the Sun is going down, the Earth is rotating away from the motion of the Sun. It's a kind of interesting bodily experience to sit on a hill looking at a sunset and to just imagine the horizon moving up to the Sun rather than the Sun moving down to the horizon. And you can almost do it. You can almost get yourself to, if you just focus, if you focus on the Sun and pretend it's staying still, and then you just will the horizon to move up. You can't actually, I've tried it. The next time you have a good sunset, just try it. See if by an act of will, you can trick your perception. And just to get that horizon to start moving up to the Sun, it doesn't really work. I mean, we're stuck with the other perception. Well, that's what a theoretical practice does. It transforms a belief that is itself a transformation of lived experience. The lived experience produces the belief. And what the scientific practice does is turn that belief into knowledge. Takes that raw material and explains to us how it comes to pass that we hold that belief and what's the what's its relationship to knowledge. That can be that the belief is true. You know, it could be some of the things we believe through our lived experience are true. That is, the scientific theory doesn't turn them into something else. Other times, it turns them into something else. But we now have knowledge of something, not just belief in something. Now, here's the part that makes this tricky. When you actually come to believe the knowledge, that is, you actually hold it as a belief, then it's an ideological product still. It just happens to be an ideological product, which, when subjected to scientific transformation, transformation corresponds to knowledge. What we're doing in this class is an ideological practice. That is, what I'm doing is telling you things which you may or may not come to believe. But this is a process of belief formation. But it's also a process of knowledge formation, because I'm engaged in argumentation and analysis and data presentation and observation, which tries to present the grounds for the beliefs that you may or may not hold, having the status of knowledge. So the relationship of science to ideology is therefore a much more complicated one. It's not one of falsity and truth. Rather, it's a relationship between two different production practices, two different sets of practices by which these objects are generated. Scientific practice takes scientific theories and observational methodologies, and et cetera, those technologies, to transform beliefs into knowledge. Ideological practices transform lived experience into beliefs. This will become a relevant contrast when we talk about mystification, that is, how our social beliefs are distortions of reality, and the problem of demystification, that is, how do we transform those social beliefs into knowledge. Well, this is a lot that I've thrown at you. One last little, on page two I make this little comment about religion. We used to actually in this class have a whole session on religion, because I think religion is a really interesting topic, and it's I don't think it's appropriate to merely fold it into ideology. I mean, not that it doesn't involve beliefs, I do think it does, but I think it has a lot of specificity to it. I think that in the most abstract way we can describe what is a religious practice. What would define a religious practice? What I like to argue is that religious practices are practices that produce a particular kind of belief. It's not just, therefore, among all the beliefs that people hold, we can distinguish different sorts of beliefs that people hold. And some of them we can then attribute to particular kinds of practices. Religious practices are practices which produce existential meaningfulness as a kind of belief that people have. So if you hold beliefs that help you understand what is meaningful about life, those beliefs, I think, can be properly thought of as the products of a religious practice. This engages the notion of religious practice from theology, however. It says that a religious practice need not have as the content of that, of the meaningfulness of life, be one that is attributed to some external being that infuses your life with meaning. You can have a humanistic religion, a religion in which the meaningfulness of life comes from our existence as social beings in deep interaction with other people. And indeed, there are currents, and this is a peculiar characteristic of American culture, well, in a society and English to some extent. There are self-identified social movements in American history that call themselves religious and denounce God. You know, they call themselves secular religions, humanistic religions. That makes sense, and it makes sense to regard Marxism as a religion in this context, if what Marxism produces is not merely knowledge about the world, nor beliefs and ideologies that enable us to act in the world in various ways, but if one of the things it produces is a sense of purpose and meaningfulness. If that aspect of Marxism, which historically has been very important in the Marxist tradition, it's one of the things that Marxism gave people, was a sense of there being some point to it all, as it were, meaningfulness. To the extent that it does that, it accomplishes the same thing that religion accomplishes. And I think it's reasonable to describe that as a religious practice. That's a way then of disengaging religion from the specific institutional forms that it takes. This also can be part of a discussion where we distinguish religion and spirituality, and indeed what we can call organized religion alienated spirituality. We're talking about spiritual practices are the real practices that generate a sense of purpose and meaning. And religion is a appropriation of this, of spirituality, and transforming it into a form of domination. That's when we have a whole session on religion. That's the shtick I leave about it. All right. It's 11:30. What should we do? Should we take a short break? I've gone on way more than
this.
Take a short break? Okay. Let's take a short break. I think there's some conventions where it's not a majority vote, there's a kind of norm, and then anyone who wants to trigger the norm can. So let's take a short break, and then we'll come back.